7,000 singing, dancing, street performing beggars for God. And we had a huge music program. So one of the people who joined the cult in the 70s, in 1972 to be exact, was a founding member of Fleetwood Mac, Jeremy Spencer. And so they created a huge music program, basically trading on the name and, of course, getting, you know, royalties and stuff. And I was being very terribly abused sexually by Jeremy Spencer. And part of, you know, part of the thing in the Children of God is we were told that all sexual activity was love. Right? That like sex was love and sex was from God. And even after they stopped the religious prostitution, internally, the cult was still, our founder called it free love, and everything was produced by us. And that was, yeah, that was our, you know, it was the Children of God was about 10,000 people strong for about 50 years. Bringing in millions and millions and millions of dollars.
I'm so happy you're here. I purposely did not do a deep dive into you. So maybe you can just start off by introducing yourself. Tell us where you're at in the world and a little bit about yourself.
Absolutely. My name is Daniela, and I'm a content creator that goes by Knitting Cult Lady on the internet. And I hail from near Washington, D.C., and I call myself a scholar of cults, extreme groups, and extremely bad leadership. And this all started because I was born and raised in a pretty extreme, serious cult called the Children of God. This is the one that is known for, one, producing Joaquin and River Phoenix and Rose McGowan, and two, also for using religious prostitution to get followers in and then eventually advocating pedophilia. So not the best place to grow up. I end up getting out of there and going into the U.S. Army after some schooling to be an intelligence officer where, you know, I become an expert on international terrorism and also deploy twice. And I wrote my first book, Uncultured, is my memoir about that. There's more. Then during COVID, I got a master's in organizational psychology. And this is when I really fine-tuned, like, I know a lot about group behavior, and it's bad groups and bad guys and tyrants and dictators and cult leaders. And I want to use that knowledge to help individuals protect themselves from groups. And so here I am with Culting of America about to come out, and we're all on this timeline. So,
okay. So first of all, I have so much to say. And also we're 2 minutes and 30 seconds in here, and you have a killer intro. You said so much I want to go back to. So first of all, my only experience with, like, cults, I guess, is I think the show on Netflix, or maybe it was on regular broadcast television, and it definitely was using religion, and there was a lot of, like, prostitution in there, child, you know, pornography, that kind of stuff. It was the Children of God, like, was there a TV show based on that? Could this be the thing I'm thinking of?
There's been a couple. There was one in the 90s that was pretty big. That's probably what you were thinking of, yes.
So you were born into this. Like, your parents were members.
I was actually born 3 generations into this. So my grandfather is the one who joined the cult and, by the way, still runs the money. My mother, at 14, is impregnated by her dad's boss, both of the men who are in finance, and that was how I came into the world in this cult.
Oh, holy shit. So, did you say your grandfather is like the head of the money for the cult?
The cult is very much not It sort of went through a whole collapse in 2009, and it somewhat exists, but the 10,000 members in an army of God living around the globe, singing and dancing and selling products, and the communes of my childhood, like, that doesn't really exist anymore.
Why is that? Like, people just didn't buy into it?
I think the internet, you know, the way that cults end short of a big conflagration is when they fail to keep the children. And the children of God actually establish really good isolation. And when you look at our older first kids born in, they tended to stay in till they were having their own kids and they were adults, like my mom did. But by the time I was coming up, you know, at 15, like, now the internet. Well, so first of all, our founder died, and cults of personality always flail when the founder dies. But then the internet, I really think, broke the isolation. And I think what we saw with Children of God, we are also seeing now with, like, Mormons, I think with MAGA, where they're not keeping the children. So even though it looks bad, they're not keeping the children.
We'll get to all that. I want to ask you all about that. But, like, maybe first you could tell me, like, yeah, my childhood was, you know, there was a lot of, like, death in my family and there was sadness within. But I've had, like, a pretty normal childhood in suburbia. What was growing up like in a cult for you?
So for, like, the first 10 years of my life, which, of course, were very formative, I saw my parents for 1 hour a day and then got to spend Sundays with them. We slept in dorms. It was sort of like growing up in a group home or an orphanage, but your parents were on site, but they're off doing whatever their ministry is for God. And the easiest way to explain it is to understand that cults are about labor, and we were labor. And all cults produce some sort of product. They're essentially organized crime. And our product was entertainment. Like, the Children of God performed twice at the White House and once for the president of Brazil, and, like, wrote a marching song for President Marcos of the Philippines. And
wait, what?
That story hasn't really been told in any kind of good way.
I want to hear about that. But also, so when you say entertainment, because in your intro, you know, my head went to, like, sex and that type of stuff. But, like, it sounds like what you're saying is you went to sing songs and that kind of stuff.
Yes. And I would argue there was always an element of messed up sexuality throughout all of the Children of God stuff. But, like, they stopped doing the technically prostitution in the 80s with the advent of the AIDS virus. And they basically went from being an escort service to being an entertainment service, providing adult and child entertainment. But I don't mean adult, like, sexual entertainment. I just mean, like, we were, like, the children of the Children of God were, like, 7,000 singing, dancing, street performing beggars for God. And we had a huge music program. So one of the people who joined the cult in the 70s, in 1972, to be exact, was a founding member of Fleetwood Mac, Jeremy Spencer. And so they created a huge music program, basically trading on the name and, of course, getting, you know, royalties and stuff that supported the cults. And then they created a huge music program. And so I personally, because I was in the leadership and because I'm a born performer, like, I was a child actor on these products, videos, tapes, you know, it was different things at the time. And we created both religious and non-religious entertainment. We created both for internal, only for the cult members, and external. But, like, in the cult, we were not allowed to see, like, basically any media from the outside, listen to no music from the outside, not even other Christian music. And everything was produced by us. And that was, yeah, that was our, you know, it was the Children of God was about 10,000 people strong for about 50 years, bringing in millions and millions and millions of dollars a year.
What did this
all over the world?
Wow. What did this money get used for?
You know, that's the thing, right? It's like, so we said we're missionaries, right? We're missionaries for God. We're here. We're begging for donations of all kinds, right? Food. We usually lived for free in places, like all this stuff. And, you know, I don't know, when I was 12, maybe, I started to realize that, like, this is a front for just supporting our communes and our way of life. So no one in the Children of God had jobs outside of the Children of God, right? That was part of the whole thing, was you completely left the, what we call the system, the outside world, and you just basically became a street beggar for God. And so a huge majority of the money that we raised was just supporting us and our lifestyle, and then sending money up to the leadership for them to do these huge video programs, create all their literature that they would put out, and then, like, obviously enrich themselves, even though they would always, of course, claim that they were beggars just like us.
It's going back to the community and to God.
Yes, exactly.
All the funds.
And then, you know, when the leader accidentally shows up with a Rolex, there's an explanation for that.
God wanted it, of course.
Yeah.
For me.
Oh, yeah. This was actually a real thing. And they were like, no, somebody donated it. And it didn't go over of the followers. Everyone was like, well, still, why didn't you sell it and then put the money in the pot? Because that's supposedly how we live.
Frankly, that's really what scares me about religion, is it can be used for all kinds of shit, you know?
And that,
it's scary.
And that's basically true of any, like, ideology, you know, like any identity that you hold can be used against you. And anytime you're in a space of personal transformation, whether that's religion, whether that's education or self-help or diet or, you know, sometimes even just moving cities, you know, like, predators will show up to take advantage of you because you're, like, open to new things and new ideas because you're changing yourself.
Definitely. Definitely. I like how you put that. Am I wrong to assume that religion is probably the number one that can be twisted in? Because that's my assumption.
I mean, so absolutely any ideology can be used to radicalize you, right? Like, you can write a sci-fi novel and then make that your worldview. And that is what Scientology is. Right. However, I think that the three patriarchal monotheistic religions that emerged 2000 years ago are already convenient worldviews for controlling people in a patriarchal, hierarchical manner. But it really can be anything. And I think it's actually, like, the stereotype of religious cult is married so hard together that people miss the fact that it's like there are yoga cults, there are Brazilian jiu-jitsu cults, there are single family cults, one cults, which I think your story probably, you know, has some of that experience.
Yeah, yeah. I want to go back to your childhood, but before I do, something you just said, or just about cults, and I know you're an expert on cults. Is there an example that exists of a good cult?
I don't think so. So, and my answer to this, I go back before the definition. Like when we are saying cult, when we're saying somebody's in a cult, we're always going to argue over what the definition of cult is. But we mean something when we use a word. And I think we mean this person has come under coercive control of someone else, right? Like negative control of someone else. And honestly, like, kind of what I felt like the master's degree in organizational psychology was, and organizational psychologists are the people that work for the big corporations and teach them how to motivate you, right? And it very much seemed like using some cult tips and tricks on people, you know, and kind of this concept of the good, like these organizations are good, or there's like a good cult. But when I get asked that question, I just think of like what people are actually asking when they say that. They don't realize this, but what you're actually saying is like, can I unhealthily manipulate people? Can I manipulate and coerce people to an unhealthy degree? But because I'm doing it for this good thing, it's good. And I argue, no, that's just ends justifies the means mentality.
Yeah, I would agree with
and
that.
It's like there's a reason leaders want that level of dedication, that cult member level of yes, I'll do anything and work yourself to death. Just like there's a reason Amazon loves to hire veterans, because they know they can work them to death, but it's not good for the individual, that's for sure.
Yeah. All right, back to your childhood real quick, if you don't mind.
Oh, and by the way, this whole childhood occurred all around the world, except the U.S., basically. So.
Oh, so this, I'm like thinking you were down south in the U.S. No, you were, where were you?
I was born in the Philippines. So I was born in the Philippines just as the Marcos dictatorship was falling, in fact. Then I spent 3.5 years in Japan. Then we spent a year in Peru. Then we spent a decade in Brazil. And then I spent a couple years as a teenager being trafficked through Mexico and lower Texas. And then when I was 15 and thrown out of the cult was when I like moved to the US for the first time.
Are we talking about prostitution?
No, I mean, not necessarily. I would argue that we were also sex trafficked because the huge majority of us were being sexually abused, but mostly labor trafficked is what I'm talking about. Like labor we were, you know, thing when I tell you this was something I didn't understand about my own life till I was 33 years old. And I heard a cult expert say cults are always about labor. And I was like, oh, like makes perfect sense.
I don't even know what to say. I mean, the craziest shit I ever heard. I mean, I feel like. So you were moving around. You weren't just at some base camp. You were
no. One of the things the children of God did that was rather brilliant was when things started heating up in America for cults, they went other places. And they ended up, you know, we had huge presence in places like India and places like Brazil, in part because you have large communes available to live on, right? Like in part because wealth disparity there means that people with money build large places behind walls. So you can have a commune there. People, you know, even though it's illegal to homeschool in Brazil, like, nobody's stopping kids on the street asking why you're not in school. And also because of wealth disparity, it's easy to convince some people to come and join your lovely, westernized, rich-looking lifestyle. And then when they start to find out the downsides, it's like you really want to go back to the slums or the favelas. And so, you know, this is a whole part of preying on people pretty much all around the globe.
Yeah. Did you, at what age did you realize this was not normal? Not so, okay. Like,
did, definitely like right around 5 or 6. And I was being very terribly abused sexually by Jeremy Spencer of Fleetwood Mac. And part of the thing in The Children of God is we were told that all sexual activity was love, right? That like sex was love and sex was from God. And even after they stopped the religious prostitution, internally, the cult was still, our founder called it free love. I call it forced polyamory. Like everyone had to sleep with everyone. And like leaders would literally make schedules, the sharing schedule of who was sleeping with who tonight.
With schedules? Whom.
Schedules.
So like at your bunk or whatever, you'd see a piece of paper and you're like, oh, 6 p.m. I'm with Frank.
Yes.
Damn it.
Exactly. Yes. I have a date with. I mean, it would be a more biblical name than that. But yes, I have a date with Jebediah today.
Jebediah.
Yeah.
With the bad breath.
Yes. And you know, it's funny, but it's also not. Like my mom's generation, like my mom was put on the sharing list at the age of 12 because that was when David Berg decided, you know, religious traditions have 12 as an age of adulthood and blah, blah, blah. I was talking about when I knew. So basically right around the age of 6, I started really understanding that like we live here behind these walls and other people don't live like this, but like, when you're in a cult, you kind of always know that because us versus them is part of it, right? So like we were the army of God. We were special. We, the family, the children of God, were like the only thing. And everyone else was the outside world and was the system. And our only reason for interacting was to try to convert people, which really ended up being to get money from people.
So if you're born into this in really know nothing else. At the age of 6, how did you know?
I mean, so I just think that, so number one, like, I don't think you can really brainwash children because brainwashing, as we understand it, mind control, like, involves an element of the person buying into it. And children, very young children, aren't rational enough for that. But when you are brought up in isolation, being only exposed to one way of life and only given one piece of exposure, a term used for that is mind rape. And that is just, you know, we were raised this way in our formative years and it was very damaging. But I personally believe that I was a neurodivergent atheist born to religious extremists. And I don't have a spiritual bone in my body. I don't care about what's afterward. You know, in contrast, I have a spiritual little child myself. So I just wasn't that person. And I just don't think that there was anything they could do to get me to buy in the cult. You know, at the age of 6, there's a different world. They're telling me if you're not in the family, you're going to go to hell. Well, hell's going to suck, you know. And by 11, I was actively trying to make a plan to leave. But one of the things that was challenging for me was, again, like my grandparents were in the cult. So being third generation, like I didn't really have links to the outside world.
Yeah. Speaking of the outside world, you're obviously street performing, as you mentioned, and going to these things. Were they gatekeeping you from the outside world? It was like when you're performing, you would do that, but right after, quick, come back? Or were there times where
100%. 100%. We were only brought out of the compound to raise funds for the cult, basically. Or if we were like actively bleeding to death.
Actively bleeding to death.
Well, because of course cults don't like medical care or education, right? So like we didn't go to school, we didn't see doctors unless it was very emergency. And we didn't, yeah, have almost any interaction with the outside world.
Hmm. Yeah.
To the point that I spent 6 years in Brazil without ever learning to speak Portuguese. I did fortunately learn it in the next 4 years after that, but.
Was there ever a time for you or someone that was your age close to you in the cult when you, when somebody approached you from the outside and were like, are you okay?
Never. In fact, I had a very weird relationship with what happened in Waco, which I actually talk about, you know, as a six-year-old in Uncultured, like hearing about this. And, you know, we were being told both we're not a cult like them, but also this is what the world and specifically America does to cults. So that's why it's so important for us to hide what we believe and what we really do and all of this stuff. But I distinctly remember as a six-year-old kid being like, yeah, but someone came for them. You know, and, you know, unfortunately, we had four countries around the world did try to come after the children of God. And in all four cases, the children were legally given back to the pedophile cult.
Talk about that. How do they come for you? Four different nations. Or try
so
to.
In Argentina in 1993, literally the same time that Waco stuff was happening, there was a big government police raid into one of the communes in Argentina, and they took, I believe, 21 kids and a bunch of adults, and that was a huge thing. In London, there was a grandmother who came for custody of her grandson, and that turned into a huge court case that pulled in a bunch. And I don't even know that I have on offhand details, but it was like, it was raids and getting the legal system involved. Unfortunately, I'm trying to figure out how much of this I can explain. Like, there was something called the Cult Wars in the US, where, you know, in the 80s, there was a demand for laws against coercive control, you know, sort of after our big waltz with cults in the 60s and 70s. And religious leaders decided that, like, if they pass laws to protect people from coercive control, they're going to take our control. So religious leaders in America got with scholars of religion and they set about demonizing cult survivors. And so, for example, the academic who came up with the term new religious movements, like, took $100,000 from the Children of God to say, no, they're not a cult. And then that could be used in places around the world. And then the other thing was, like, they just had us trained so well, you know? And I try to show this in Uncultured too, where I'm like, I literally say, like, I was thinking about being raided and all of that. And, like, I was almost as afraid that I would have to go as I was that I would have to stay. You know, and that's the real tragedy of disorganized attachment in children. You know, when children are raised by caregivers that are not safe for them, they still have to love them. You know, you still, like, I still didn't want to be taken away from my family. And looking back, right, it's like, yeah, if we had told anyone, in theory, you know, I could have grabbed anyone's hand at any time and been like, I'm being abused. I'm not paid for this performance. Like, but you're not going to do that if you're taught the whole outside world is evil. I would just say one of the things I tell people now, children and teenagers that can't leave cults or their family situation, is just like, just survive until you're old enough to get out. And just know that the outside world is not as bad as they tell you.
Yeah, that's good advice. That's good advice. I was just going to say, I keep thinking about how you realized at six that, and you said, you know, you didn't really buy into it. You didn't, like, feel this way as a human. But I'm thinking about if I was to be born and know nothing else, how could I possibly? I mean, I guess I could have an inkling like this isn't really for me, but like.
So that's what it was. And then I would just tell you, like, I, you know, now I know that I am a woman with autism and ADHD and like pretty classic autism. Like my readers diagnosed me from my memoir first. And when I was 6 years old, caregivers started saying to me, oh, you argue so much, you should be a lawyer, right? And that's like something I would actively get in trouble for. Now I know that children go through like a lawyering phase, but my little neurodivergent brain, honestly, at the age of six, like hung on to that, like, I'm going to be a lawyer. When I grew up, I'm going to be a lawyer. So I had this like, and it pulled me all the way into college.
Are you in touch with anyone still in Children of God?
Like, I sometimes get a message from my grandfather on Christmas or my birthday, but otherwise, no.
What does he say?
Usually just happy birthday and I love you. You know, he's one of those ones that I don't think will ever wake up.
How old is he?
Definitely in his 70s. Yeah.
You know where he is? Philippines?
No, he lives in Texas.
Texas.
We know where he is now, you know, like yeah. Now it's basically an online church that has some followers and
oh yeah.
I'm sure
that's right.
I'm sure they're still coercing people and taking money, but it's definitely not what it was. You know, like they did reach their tipping point in 2009 and this was when they kind of, you know, the new leader and her husband just were kind of like, so guys, Jesus told us he's not coming back in our lifetime anymore, you know?
Yeah.
So like, you can stay, but, and like, that was the whole mission of the cult. So that had a lot of, that basically like blew up the cult. And one of the things that's interesting is, so we now have in our survivor community a bunch of ex-members, both adults who joined and children who were born and raised in it, who never left, right? And we literally call them never lefters because they didn't like, they didn't have a crack in the brainwashing and wake up and go through the decision to leave everything behind and go into an unknown world for freedom, right? They just, the cult sort of melted around them. Those people tend to go right into other high control groups, which is unsurprising. Many of them are now MAGA.
Yeah. Anyone from your age, from Children of God, that made it out, or you know their story, or you talk to?
Yeah, I have many, many peers. I mean, I have 25 siblings.
Good. I didn't even think about that. Oh my God.
You know, there's a lot of people that I still talk to. There's a lot of people that don't talk to me anymore because I wrote the book. And even in the ex-member community, that can still, you know, cause a lot of drama for people. And then, you know, I would also say there's also a lot of us that are not around anymore. We have an extremely, extremely high suicide rate that's been compared to like the suicide rate of Holocaust survivors, which is, you know, I don't think to say we reach the same level of horror, but like there's experiences that humans have that some people never recover from. And we have a, you know, first, in both my cult survivor and my veteran community, like I have a lot of that. And so like three of my 25 siblings are not alive. One through medical neglect as a child and two through suicide.
Sorry.
Thank you.
I bet a lot of people weren't happy that you wrote that memoir.
No, there was definitely, and a lot of survivor communities can be like that, which is the like, no, be the shiny, quiet. You know, when I was an army captain, when I was the one that had survived our childhood and blah, blah, blah. And I was still willing to talk about it with a like, yeah, I was an international missionary and I speak three languages. Everyone was fine with me. But as soon as I wanted to come out and say, hey, this was problematic, people start to get very upset. And I experience, you know, half of the book is about the military and it is criticizing the United States military, essentially, and comparing it to a cult. And I upset a lot of people there, too.
I bet.
Yeah. Good news is I've been upsetting cult members for 20 years. So, like, I'm good with it.
Yeah. Well, you know, fuck them, right?
I mean, so like when I did Uncultured, you know, it was so healing. And I think that people who've had trauma, right, struggle to decide if they want to write a book or do something, because as you and I both know, that means you're entering into the trauma entertainment industry. And that can be challenging. However, the ability to go through my life and sort things and put it down, I think was like very healing, you know. And for me, as a survivor who struggled with suicidal ideology for decades, it was very healing for me to turn my story into something that could help other people figure out their process. And then the other thing is like, you know, we talk about the benefit of owning your story, but we don't talk about the benefit of owning your story. You know, I took all of the worst things that happened to me in my life that I couldn't control. And I really struggled with this photo because they wanted to use this photo on the cover. And I was just like, it feels so exploitative, right? Like this is me as a 2-year-old in Japan being trafficked as a performer. And if it wasn't distressed here, you would see the dead black eyes on the baby. But I went through this process with myself of like, Daniela, you have been exploited your whole life, you know, by a cult, by, I think, the military, patriarchy, all of this, right? And now the only one exploiting me is me. You know, like I didn't get to choose that trauma, but like I get to choose what to do with it now. And I own those stories now.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it takes a strong person to put it all out there and just the good moments, the bad moments, the embarrassing moments, or whatever, put it all out there for what you want to do with it. And what was your reason for the memoir? Was it therapeutic? Was it just something you wanted to do? Why'd you do it?
So I had like two moments. I mean, I always knew I was going to write a book. I've always been a writer and an artist and a thinker. And I started trying to write my first memoir when I was 24 in Afghanistan, and it was shockingly bad. But, you know, I had been thinking I would do it eventually. I had two moments, and the first one was when I listened to someone else's memoir and it did it for me. Like, I got done listening to it. It was a book called Educated. And I said, why didn't I write that first? And then I was like, no, that's the model. Right. And so I said, I'm going to write the next one of those.
Did it help you?
It did help me. Like it, you know, I think one of the big reasons we read memoir is because we're trying to figure out the context and the language to tell our own stories. You know, so like before I knew how to talk about growing up in a religious prison labor camp or being enslaved for my childhood, I was reading all of these different stories of people like Holocaust survivors or people who have escaped North Korea and enslaved people, because I was trying to figure out how to tell my story. And so the idea of like being in this tradition of like, this book helped me. I wrote the next one of those. And then it actually just happened 2 months ago, a really big book sold to Simon & Schuster, and it was for readers of Daniela Messineck Young's Uncultured and Tara Westover's Educated. You know, a very, like, cool moment. And then the second one was, so I would say 2 years in, like, I was heavily working on the book. We were already shopping it. We had already had a lot of rejections. And a lot of people were saying some version of, we don't do Children of God because the abuse is too terrible, which I think is really not giving enough trust to the reader.
Yes. Yeah.
If I survived it, I think people can survive the story. And then I would get rejections from the military side, and people would say, well, we don't do books about women in the military because nobody reads them. And then this woman named Vanessa Guillen went missing, and they didn't look for her for 60 days. And that's important, because if a rifle goes missing for 60 minutes, they will shut down the entire base and everyone will look for that weapon. Right? When they found her, when they looked, they found her very quickly, body in three shallow graves. And this became kind of a moment for, it was like our Me Too movement for the military became hashtag I am Vanessa Guillen. And I was, you know, this was actually my first experience going viral with the phrase, every woman I know has been assaulted, like every woman veteran. And I, you know, thought to myself, you know, I'd be getting these rejections, and nobody reads books about military women. And in fact, there hadn't been to that point a full length memoir in the mass market by a woman veteran. And I was sitting there going, like, why? Like, why doesn't America care the way that the Daughters of America are treated when we disappear behind the high commune walls of the Department of Defense? And then my brain said, somebody needs to bleed their story onto the page and get a big enough book deal that they can do it in the shadow of the Pentagon without having to ask permission to protest. And then 1 second later, I was like, oh, that's me. You know, and yeah. I knew because of my big cult story, right? Because I'm white, because of all these reasons, like I could do Uncultured, and I could be that person to kind of kick the door down totally, to allow women veterans to tell our stories, like our full stories, without having to pick. A lot of former memoirs are amazing, but they had to play nice with the Pentagon in order for the military industrial complex to support the book. And I have found that Americans definitely read stories about military women. Well, they just don't want to read what the Department of Defense is telling you to say. They want to read the honest, real story.
Totally, totally. And, you know, just on a personal note, like, I'm glad you stuck with it. And I can relate to getting a shit ton of rejection, because when I took my proposal out, you know, all the big boys, Random House, and, you know, rejection, and some that were nice enough to include feedback. You know, it was just the reason why they were rejecting it. And, you know, it's like, you guys don't have a fucking clue what the people want and why.
Yeah. Why? Like, you know, that's so interesting right now, because I actually don't think the traditional gatekeepers have any power anymore, right? Like, they're losing all of their ability, and people can just go out. Like, so Culting of America, my second book, it's very controversial, and my publisher didn't want it. So I'm doing it as an indie book. And I have a bigger platform now than I did when Uncultured came out. So I've already sold, you know, more in pre-sales on my own than I did with a big company behind me.
Interesting you say that. So I am curious, is money makes the world go round, right? So like self-publishing your indie book, however you did it, is that more or less lucrative than teaming up with a big boy?
So it definitely depends, right? I think Macmillan sank about $500,000 into Uncultured. Like, that was their investment to get the product.
Yep.
I, by making my own labor free, am putting about that investment into the next book to make it very good. And the thing people don't realize about books is it's like venture capital, right? You're betting that this thing is going to sell well. You're betting that it's going to go viral. I'm feeling pretty good right now because I wrote a book called The Culting of America and we're on this timeline, right? So like, it seems like it's going good. But unless you are going to be out there selling your own book every day, it might not happen. And turns out, selling books from the virtual street corner is what I was made for. So, you know, one of the things I would say to you is, like, right now, I think trying to convince the big boys to take a risk on something they don't think is going to work might not be where an author or creator wants to expend their energy. Because, like, I promise you, nobody thought the market for knitting and talking about cults and tyrants was this big. I'm also doing cool things like launching knitting needles that look like swords, along with my very serious, you know, book. And the way a traditional publisher would have just laughed at me, and yet my audience can't get enough of it.
That's great. And you're doing what you want to do. I was just like curious. And then what you've said about how the gatekeepers like don't have control. I forget how you phrase it. There was one, I forget the publisher company, but it was one of the big ones. It was, I don't know, I can't imagine the people that make the final say so are writing feedback. So this is like a, you know, somebody that reports to somebody, probably reports to somebody, but he wrote back. He was like, I love this so much, and I just have to convince more people on my team, and then we're go. And it was like at the end of the paragraph, and I'm just like, it's so funny because you look back at the success of Blink, the podcast that put, I pivoted. You know, I wrote forever and I shot this for what felt like ever. It was during COVID. I don't know if that had something to do with it or not. Probably.
Yes, it did.
It did. I was about to say probably not. But anyway, I was like, you took the enjoyment of writing because I also had like, you know, I was rep by CAA and they were giving me all this feedback. Oh, do this. Don't do that. Don't talk about this. Save that for the second book. In my head, I'm like, how will there be a second book if there isn't a first book? But you know so much more than me, so I'm going to trust you and fine, let me do this. And
yeah, and like, if you have built your own platform the way that you have, having a book is a great return on investment. You know, I've paid multi-hundred-thousand-dollars into this by selling signed copies of Uncultured, which also is proving my audience for the next book, right? Actually, one of the things that me and my talent manager and my indie publisher, who's a woman Navy veteran, are trying to do is build a replicable model for people like you and I who have stuff to say and don't necessarily want to have to go try to convince the big boys. Because that's also the other thing, is that you don't need as much of a return on investment if you're the one selling it on a small scale, right? Like, true. I don't need to sell 100,000 books a year for this to look good on a balance sheet. Selling 10,000 a year keeps me great.
The bigger you go, the more people get their cuts. I don't know if you ever heard my podcast, Blink, kind of pivoted from the book. I'm not saying the book's over. There will be a book one day for sure. Gave me a little like, aha, guys. Like, you know, this was voted like best of 2025 podcasts. Like, you know, listen to that junior associate that was telling you guys this could have been amazing, you know?
Yes. And like when you were saying they were like, oh, save this for the second book. Like so many people told me that my life story was two different books, that I couldn't put it in one book. That like first it was a story about a call and then it was a story about the army. But well, I like insisted because I was like, no, I know these two together are important.
Who said that to you? Like which type of people, like agents or?
Some agents, but I got an agent pretty quickly, but it was like editors, like the rejections, you know, was this is two books. I don't get it. When we briefly tried to sell a film, we were getting the same thing. Like, I don't get the vision. And that's one of the things about like doing it yourself. You know, like I also had so many straight white men tell me that I would never be able to make a business only focusing on bad leadership and bad guys. And like, we're the Knitting Cult brand is doing pretty good, you know? So traditionally published books are good because they get so many people working on it. Right. And if you, what I don't want authors to do is like just trauma dump your story and then go publish it, right? Like there's still like a lot of development, a lot of craft that goes into it. But right now, it's anyone's game, you know, like how you can get your stuff to go viral and get people to buy your stuff. And, you know, so an example is like when Taylor Swift got on country music, right? Like that was all she had to do, in heavy quotes, was convince the gatekeepers to put her song on the radio. And then once it was on the radio, everyone was hearing it. However, for like the Sabrinas and the Olivia Rodrigos, like everyone's not on the same channels anymore. Everyone's on different channels. So it's much harder to kind of go nationally or internationally viral in an organized, predictable way.
Totally.
And that's why I think the gatekeepers have lost control. And I think right now there's an amazing opportunity for people that have stories to tell or expertise to share that know, right? Like you and I know there's a market for our story. We know there are people that want to hear it because we're telling it all the time and people are saying you should write a book. But you have to try to go convince someone that your life story is going to make them $500,000. That's pretty difficult.
At least, yeah. How did you get out of this Children of God cult?
So when I was 15, I basically got myself expelled.
What do you mean expelled? Like they treated this like a middle school?
It's called excommunication. Force you out. You know, most cults, it's funny that there's this stereotype of like cults don't let you leave. Because sure, they're using all sorts of coercive tactics to keep you there. But once you decide you want to be gone, the cult wants you gone as fast as possible.
Really?
Because they don't want you to infect other people.
Interesting.
And so I knew at 15, I was like, I need to break the biggest, baddest rule out there. I need them to think like I'm a completely lost cause. That way they'll throw me out. And to me, it was important that it happened before I was 16, because at 16, we were considered full adults and there was a lot of sex and no birth control. And I knew like getting away would be much harder. So one night I climbed over the walls of the commune and went out and slept with a boy that I liked out in the world. And
so wait, you climbed the walls and you meet a boy within how many hours? Or you already knew
him? Oh, like it was at this point we had a little more interaction in the outside world. And so it was like a boy that I knew from our neighborhood and we had been like secretly seeing each other. And so he invited me over and I was like, okay, I'll come at midnight. And I very dramatically scaled the walls and climbed over the roof and then fell asleep and got caught because I didn't sneak back in.
Can you just tell me a little bit about what a Children of God or a cult compound is like? You said scale these walls. Like, do they have guards?
I didn't live in places with guards ever, but this is what I meant about, like, in a lot of non-white Western countries where you have a lot of wealth disparity, you have walls around all the nice houses. Like, actually, the most surprising thing for me when I first set foot in America was that there are just nice houses that you can just walk up to on the street, right? Like, that's basically the benefit of having a large middle class, is you can have your castles out on the street without walls. I suspect, in part, lived in so many developing nations because you had, you know, you have houses that are built for multi-generational families, plus potentially servants. Like, I slept in the maid's quarters in this last commune, which is part of why I was able to sneak out. And then you have a big wall around it with like a gate and anyone. And that's just like a normal thing in fancier neighborhoods. And so we would almost always, like my whole life until I moved to the United States, I lived behind some kind of large cement wall that separated me from the outside world.
And you scale this gate, you meet up with this guy you knew or were sneaking around with, and you fell asleep. And that's what caused you to be excommunicated.
Yes. And so basically at this point, it was like, I committed the unforgivable sin, fellowship with the outsider, and my parents.
Is that what they call it? Fellowship yes. With the outsider? Yeah. That's what they actually said to you.
Sexual fellowship. Yeah. And so at this point, my parents either had to find a place for me or leave themselves, right? Because I was just 15. And there's always a third option too with cults, which cults will forgive almost any sin if you will completely, you know, humiliate yourself, bow down, buy in harder, do all of this stuff. And I was considering it. Because I was 15 and I knew nothing about the outside world and I was scared. And I will say, to my mom's credit, you know, she took me outside the walls and she was like, look, go. You know, they had found. So my mom at the age of 20 was married off to an older cult guy in the leadership who was 40. So I have a bunch of older step siblings. And so a step-sibling that I had met exactly 3 times was asked if she would adopt the 15-year-old. And she said yes. And so I was dropped off in Houston, Texas with $0 and a passport and a social security card.
The cult or your parents kept that, I assume, from you. And then you had one, so they gave it to you then.
Yeah. And that was all of the documentation I had, right? So here I am trying to enroll in high school, a 16-year-old girl who speaks fluent English. The only thing I have, like, I have no records. I've never had a vaccination.
Oh, my God.
They literally said to me, we cannot enroll you here because you don't exist. But if you don't bring proof that you're enrolled somewhere in 5 days, we have to call the cops.
Man, why wouldn't they fucking be like, we're worried about you? Like,
this is so hard. I think high school was the hardest part of some of all of it, because it was like, you know, so for example, the first time I took a Scantron test or a bubble sheet test, I took it in pen. And I had no idea that you weren't supposed to do that. And so I get back a test that is a zero. And so I'm trying to talk to the teacher about why I got a zero. But what he's looking at is a 16-year-old girl who speaks perfect English and seems just like any other American kid who, like, must be pretending not to know how this works.
Right.
So it was like this very tragic comedy of errors where I don't know what I'm doing and I don't know what I'm doing wrong.
Where can people find your books?
Yeah, so Uncultured, you can get it anywhere you buy books. It was a big Macmillan book. It's also available on audio. It's on Spotify Premium, also anywhere you get your books, and tons of libraries. And Culting of America is available for pre-sale only, and that will be linked here. And it comes out January 20th.
Right, perfect. You heard it, folks. I'm going to go listen to the audiobook tonight in preparation for part two. And final question, I hope you don't kill me. You got to tell me about the knitting. Where did the knitting come from? When did the knitting start?
So my mom taught me how to knit when I was 5. She taught herself how to knit when she was 17 in quarantine with her second baby from a book. My mom's incredible. When I was 5, she taught me to knit. I think I'm one of those people that just picked it up right away. I watched my own kid do it. And whenever we had, my mom was craft mom. And whenever we had supplies, she would teach us, like, knitting, crocheting, cross stitching, art. And it wasn't till I was in college and I took a learning test and they were like, so you have the most unique form of learning and it's called body kinesic, meaning you code things in through movement. And I was like, oh, I can knit. And so I went out and I got a book stand and knitting needles and I knit my way through college. I knit my way through the army. Psychologically, I would say that as a child, I spent a lot of time in solitary confinement. Obviously, nothing like you went through, but a day is a long time when you're a child. And I think I, like, have this absolute fear of being stuck somewhere with nothing to do. And so it's like I always have my project. That's kind of a safety thing. And then I got online and I started talking to people. And when I would talk, I would just talk. But when I read, I'm always knitting. It keeps the words on the page for me. And so I would be reading and knitting, which is also a way to really bring it home for people that you're not looking at what you're doing. And so many people started commenting on it. And I was like, okay, we can do this more. And it's become a really beautiful part of healing. Doing, you know, making my own clothes, taking things apart, creating my own look. And I like to think literally like knitting thoughts together as we're here, like unraveling all these bad groups.
Totally. That's beautiful. It's beautiful.
Thank you.
And you knit all your own clothes. Is that what
I said? One other thing, misogynists sort themselves right out. Misogynists hate knitting. I have a lot of thoughts about why, but I don't make all my own clothes. But these days, like right now, if you're watching the video, I made this cuff, this collar, these earrings, this scarf again, and I added a cool little knit banner to this little tank top that I have.
I want something. Would you make me something one day?
Absolutely. What do you want?
I don't even know.
Maybe an F-bomb. One of the things I make for men is a little stuffed, like, hand grenade that says F on it. And those are fun.
I drop those a lot, so that sounds perfect. Okay, thank you so much. And I'm going to go check out your book.